revisionist history of war. In a sense, I'm going to make a few comments about this before I get started. In a sense, all history is revisionist history. In some of my research regarding Lincoln and the Civil War, I got to know the literature of a lot of the Lincoln scholars, as they call themselves. I call them the Lincoln cult, but they're the Lincoln scholars. But every one of them has written 3, 4, 5, 10 books on Lincoln. Well, why would you need to write another book on Lincoln unless you're a revisionist? You're revising something, new knowledge, a different interpretation, new facts come about. And so all of history is revisionist history as far as that goes. And so, but the establishment are gatekeepers. When my book, The Real Lincoln, first came out more than 20 years ago, and I knew what was going to happen. I knew I was going to kick over a hornet's nest and called all kind of bad names and everything like that, but I didn't care. Paul Craig Roberts wrote me an email that said, "You've destroyed their human capital. That's why they're attacking you." The establishment interpretation of all that. They spent 30, 40, 50 years writing book after book after book about St. Lincoln, and then I come along and I just lay out these facts and it contradicts them. That's why, for example, when Judge Napolitano was invited to be on the Daily Show, television show, to talk about Lincoln, because he wrote about Lincoln in one of his books on the Constitution, he sent me a list of questions that they gave him. And then when he showed up, they had Eric Foner from Columbia and a whole bunch of people to argue with him. And he said, the first thing Eric Foner asked him was, "Do you know DiLorenzo?" So he wanted to know if he knew anything about Lincoln, because if he said no, then he could just keep on lying through his teeth like he's been doing for 45 years. So the establishment wants you to think that all revisionist history is like Holocaust denial, because they call those people revisionists, and they call themselves revisionists. And so they want to kind of smear you any way they can with that. But it's all this way. The second point I'd like to make about this, about the revisionist history, is some things that Mises said, that history is just a collection of facts, and you have to interpret the facts in some way. Mises also said economic history is also just a collection of facts and statistics, but if you don't have some sort of guiding theory that makes sense, then everything's open to ad hoc interpretations, and tomorrow's interpretation can be totally different than today's interpretation. And Mises was making the argument that praxeology is especially important, and that's been for my whole career, that's very important. You have to have an economic worldview if you're going to talk about something like war. It's not the only worldview. It's not the only view, but you have to be somewhat equipped with that. And also, you combine that with the Rothbardian view of the state, you'll ask very different questions when you're studying history, and you'll come up with very different interpretations than you do. When I first started getting into that whole literature on Lincoln and the Civil War and the economics of the Civil War, I was in Baltimore, and I took a course at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, and they had all the big shot Ivy League lecturers on the Civil War there. And I started asking them, what book or books would you recommend on Lincoln's economic policies? Because every president has some economic policies, and none of them mentioned a word about it. And they gave me this one book. They all said this one book, that's the book, read that book, Lincoln and the American Dream, it's called. And I read it, and it had silly things like, Lincoln was a lifelong advocate of protectionist tariffs because he wanted the common man to have a chance to become wealthy like he had become wealthy. And it was just total BS. And that's one of the reasons why I got into that. And that's the sort of things they wanted to preserve. So if you have just an inkling of education in economics, you would dismiss all of this in a second in that book, let alone some of the more sophisticated arguments. So those are two things I'd like to mention about this, that I think, in my opinion, all good history is revisionist history. When I first started researching Lincoln, I quoted Lerone Bennett Jr. as saying there'd already been, I think he said there were 16,000 books in print on Lincoln at the time. So that's a lot of revisionism, isn't it? 16,000 books. Okay. And so we're not doing anything unusual here today or this week. And so those are... basically my introductory comments for now about what we're doing here. And now on to my topic. I'm a little ahead of the schedule, but that's okay. We can have a little Q&A maybe. Let's see. I don't want to get things mixed up here. Well, my topic, I've talked about this in another conference here, but we're publishing this as a book. And by the way, it's not too late to be a sponsor of the book. Just find Christy Holmes, our director of development, talk to her about that. And so I've talked about this before, but I decided this is what I want to write my chapter on in the book. Okay, it's called False Virtue. And as I said, I've talked about this before. Some of you have heard parts of this talk before, but I'm going to rewrite this and write it into the book chapter. And so even if we have to transcribe all the speeches, we're going to publish this as a book, all the presentations from here. Well, it starts with the famous writer, Robert Penn Warren, who, he's the author of All the King's Men. He won a Pulitzer Prize for that. He's also a poet. He won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for poetry. He was a Southern agrarian. In 1960, I think it was Life magazine, invited him to write a book on the centennial of the Civil War, or which I prefer to call the War to Prevent Southern Independence. Okay, and this is the little book he came up with. It's called The Legacy of the Civil War. This little blue book, very interesting. He was a very brilliant man. And he said that the government used the war as a way of giving itself a treasury of virtue. The United States government was said to have a treasury of virtue. And he said this, this is a quote, "The war gave Northerners, who ran the government, after the war, a plenary indulgence for all past sins, past, present, and future." Wow. So they were so virtuous at the end of the war, after slaughtering hundreds of thousands of fellow citizens, that there were a plenary indulgence for anything the U.S. government would do forevermore, because it was the U.S. government that was doing it. And he also said that whenever there's a dispute about such things, if one side claims a monopoly of virtue, that historically has been used to do just about anything. The mass murder of women and children, the bombing of cities occupied by civilians, whatever, because you've got the monopoly of virtue and the other side does not. So he warned about that. And then he said, but you have to forget a lot of history in order to believe that the U.S. government, under people like U.S. Grant or William McKinley or people like that, are the most virtuous people on planet Earth. You have to forget a lot of actual Civil War history. And here's what Robert Penn Warren said in his book about what must be forgotten. "It must be forgotten that the Republican Party platform pledged the protection of slavery," which it did. "Republicans were ready to guarantee slavery in the Constitution," which they were. Lincoln himself endorsed the Corwin Amendment to the Constitution, which would have prevented the federal government from ever interfering in slavery. And he did so in his first inaugural address, right there, named after an Ohio congressman. "Both houses of Congress announced that the war was not about slavery, but saving the Union." That was the Crittenden-Johnson resolution, also known as the War Ames resolution. They announced to the world that we have no intention in disturbing the domestic institutions of the states, by which they meant slavery. So you have to forget about that. You're not allowed to know that. Okay. You have to forget that the Emancipation Proclamation emancipated no one, because it only applied to rebel territory, and even including West Virginia, the last slave state to enter the Union, seceding illegally, by the way, because it didn't involve the Virginia legislature, as the Constitution requires, by the Lincoln administration. So all the parishes in Louisiana where the Union Army was in control were specifically exempted by name from the Emancipation Proclamation. And when I visited the Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield, Illinois, they had in one of the rooms, they had a big video display, and they had the face of an ex-slave and then a voiceover of his words saying, we heard about this proclamation, but we didn't think anything of it because we were still slaves. So they knew. You know, maybe the American public was bamboozled, one of Murray Rothbard's favorite words, but the slaves weren't. Most northern states refused Negro suffrage after the war, Robert Penn Warren wrote. I imagine the Lincoln cult would say, well, we don't want Negroes to suffer. Who wants that to happen? After the war, Sherman opposed arming of black people. Lincoln famously said in a debate with Stephen Douglas, and this is a direct quote of Lincoln, I am not nor ever have been in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the black and white races. I, as much as any man, want the superior position to belong to the white race. You can't get much more of a white supremacist than that. He even used the word superior in that. So the people during Lincoln's time knew him and knew that. That's what was known. But Robert Penn Warren says you need to forget all of this. You need to forget all of that. You just need to believe what I was taught in Pennsylvania public school, that Lincoln was so honest that he once walked 6 miles to return a penny to a merchant who he had underpaid, and then 6 miles back home. And I don't remember my teacher at the time saying that it was uphill both ways, but it probably was. One of the very first biographies of Lincoln after his death actually said that his mother was the most chaste woman since the Virgin Mary herself. And it also said in the same book that his father was illiterate, and the only book he ever read was the Bible. And so Robert Penn Warren goes on to say, the treasury of virtue is a consciously undertaken crusade so full of righteousness that there is enough overplus stored in heaven, like the deeds of the saints, to take care of all the small failings of the descendants of the Crusaders. Well, the descendants of the Crusaders, think Hillary Rodham Clinton, or some, you know, pick your descendant. Clyde Wilson called Hillary once a museum quality specimen of a Yankee. You think of looking at some weird bug under glass. You know, there's a Hillary. There's Hillary's face right there. And so, and then the final thing about him he's going to say is, the effect of the treasury of virtue is to make us lie automatically. You know, we repeat all this stuff over and over and over again. We all lie automatically. And this all morphed into American exceptionalism, which was used as the reason for never-ending bombardment of people all over the world. The real American foreign policy for a long time was captured perfectly in a bumper sticker that I saw in Baltimore once when I was living there. It had an American flag on one corner, and it said, do as we say or we will bring democracy to your country. And the treasury of virtue is what's supposed to justify all of this. And it's not a surprise, by the way, that the descendants or the ancestors of these people are the people who conducted the Salem witch trials in Massachusetts. It's the same sort of zealot idea that we are morally superior to everyone else, and we therefore have a right to do anything, you know, set women on fire who we don't like. I can think of a few I would recommend if I was around back then to do that. So what did they do with all this this virtue? I'm going to be way ahead of our schedule here, but I guess that's okay. I'm only supposed to be starting now. Maybe we should all take a 10-minute nap.
It's okay. I always go over time. So.
Okay, Scott goes over time. Yeah, we got a lot of big mouths on the agenda today, as far as that goes. So what did they do with all this virtue, all this great virtue? Another book I would recommend, there's a little book called The Deification of Lincoln, if you're interested in this. It published in 1943 by Ira Cardiff, C-A-R-D-I-F-F. There aren't that many books about this. Well, how did this come about? In his own time, there's a book on Lincoln that says that he was the most hated and reviled of all American presidents. Larry Tagg is the author of that one. And based on magazine articles, newspaper articles, things during his time. But then this was all transformed by the Republican Party and the clergy. Okay, and there was one lithograph that I used to have in my files somewhere of a Harper's Magazine article in 1866, and it was an angel ascending to heaven, big angel's wings, and below the angel there was an open tomb, and then the head of the angel was Abraham Lincoln. and they would said things like, he died on Good Friday, which is true, and they said things like, they compared him to Jesus Christ, and then sometimes they compared him to Moses by saying he led his people to the promised land, but he never made it there himself. And so that's the kind of nonsense for decades Americans were subjected to, and that's how the treasury of virtue was cemented into place over the years. Until I came along, I could brag on that. So what did they do with all this virtue that was built up during the war? Well, the first thing they did was 3 months after the war ended, General Sherman, a delightful fellow, was put in charge of the military district of the Missouri, which was all land west of the Mississippi. And his basic assignment was to commence a war of genocide against the Plains Indians, which lasted for 25 years, more or less under his supervision. And they ended up killing some 45,000 Indians. And Sherman early on made this statement. This is from a biography by Michael Fellman, a biography of Sherman. Sherman himself said, "We are not going to let a few thieving, ragged Indians check and stop the progress of the railroads." And of course, Lincoln was a wealthy railroad attorney, the general counsel of the Illinois Central. He represented all the big railroads in the Midwest. He was offered the job of general counsel of the New York Central by Erasmus Corning. He turned it down because he had bigger fish. That was 1857, I think. And so the whole railroad industry was linked. There's a book called Lincoln and the Railroads, if anybody's interested. I think it was John Starr. I know the last name was Starr with two R's, but I forget the first. I don't know. Can't remember if the first name was John or something else, but you can find it if you want to look for it. And so that's what Sherman's job was to do. And at the time, the government was, when the war broke out in June of 1861, Lincoln called Congress back to Washington. And here's Robert E. Lee amassing a giant army a few miles away. And what is the subject? To get the legislation started on the Pacific Railway Bill. we got to start paying off the people who put us in office. And so they did, and they gave the president the right to determine where they would start building the Transcontinental Railroad. The government subsidized Transcontinental Railroads, and he had 3 years earlier he had invested in a big piece of land in Council Bluffs, Iowa, personally. Where do you think he chose the starting point? Any guess? Anyone want to guess? And to this day, it's called Lincoln's Hill in the Council Bluffs. And I always thought that's probably why he turned the job down of the general counsel of the New York Central Railroad, because he knew he was hoping he was going to make a killing, which I'm sure he did on that railroad. And so that was the beginning of the war of the Plains Indians, because they wanted to make way for the railroads. And that's one thing that Sherman said about that. Then Michael Fellman, the historian, writing about Sherman, he said, "The great triumvirate of the Union Civil War effort, Generals Grant, Sherman, and Philip Sheridan, pursued what Sherman called the final solution to the Indian problem." And I've quoted that, and all people have asked me, is that where Hitler got this? Who knows? Maybe. Hitler did quote Lincoln's first inaugural address in Mein Kampf, though. He said something to the effect that the states did not create the Union created the states. And Hitler kind of liked that idea because he wanted to destroy all the states in Germany and have one big centralized power. Yeah, I wrote that in an article after I debated Harry Jaffa, and he told me that he's a De Lorenzo would probably agree with Hitler on this stuff. So I wrote an article about how Jaffa is like, his views are identical to Hitler's views on federalism, state rights, and yeah, I think I called it Jaffa's Hitlerian defense of Hitler. If you can look it up on lewrockwell.com, I looked the day after I got home from Oakland, California, and I wrote that up. Because I remembered as an undergraduate, I had a European history class, and they gave us readings of Mein Kampf. And so there might be a picture out there somewhere of me walking around a campus with a copy of Mein Kampf. So my critics would love that. We'd love to get that. Okay. So anyway, the final solution to the Indian problem, they were joined by other Union Army luminaries such as John Pope, O.O. Howard, George Armstrong Custer, Benjamin Grierson, and Winfield Scott Hancock. And like I said, they eventually killed, the historians say, at least 45,000 Plains Indians. And this included the women and children. Of course, they would sneak up on Indian villages in the wintertime when they knew families would all be together. And by then, they had Gatling guns and rifled cannon, and they would just obliterate everybody, animals included. And they also had a sort of a massive killing of buffaloes in the plains, because the Indians relied on buffaloes for everything, food, clothing. They even used the tiny little bones for fish hooks. And they would, if a baby was born in the middle of winter, they would kill a buffalo and gut it and put the baby inside the carcass to keep it from freezing to death. They used the buffalo for everything. And so part of the U.S. policy was the decimation of the buffalo herds. It wasn't just the tragedy of the commons, like economists talk about, that the shooting of the buffalo. It was government policy to try to starve to death the Plains Indians at the same time. Yeah. And these are the people who were supposed to be racial saints. And they also recruited ex-slaves, and they named them buffalo soldiers, and they make movies about them, and they're all heroes. But they were waging genocide against another different race, basically, and being paid for it. Sherman, of course, justified all this. This is his use of the treasury of virtue was what all of this was done in the shadow of. And here's a quote from Sherman. "The Indians give a fair illustration of the fate of the Negroes if they are released from the control of the whites." That was General Sherman saying that, our racial saint. And Mises, by the way, wrote about imperialism, he noted that imperialist powers, whether it's Germany or Russia or even the U.S., they always seem to pick first on countries that where they call the people the lesser races. They took them a while to have the nerve to wage war against other people who they thought were of their own enlightened race, and so this would be a good example of what Mises was talking about, I think. And Michael Feldman, the biographer, said Sherman's war in the Plains Indians had the objective of a racial cleansing, quote, a racial cleansing of the land. And then they quote Sherman again as saying this: "All the Indians will have to be killed or maintained as a species of paupers." Well, they achieved that, didn't they? To this day, there's Indian reservations. Last time I was in Montana, I drove by a lot of them, and they still have Indian reservations. And he said, "And they must be obliterated or beg for mercy." Those are Sherman's words. And Sherman actually gave Sheridan, Sherman was sitting back there in Washington, and Sheridan was the executioner, Philip Sheridan, the man who burned out the Shenandoah Valley after the Confederate Army left during the war and burned down all the private homes and things like that. He gave this order from Sherman: authorization to slaughter as many women and children as well as men, because they said it would be too time-consuming to distinguish between men, the braves versus the squaws and the children. So just kill everybody. Where have I heard that recently? Okay, and then this gem from Sherman. This is a letter after a couple of years of this. Sherman writes General Sheridan, a letter saying, quote, I am charmed at the handsome conduct of our troops in the field. Charming. He's very charmed, all that. There's a man named S.L.A. Marshall, who was the official government historian of the history of the European theater of war in World War II. He wrote 35 books on American military history. And he said this about Sherman's order to Sheridan during the Indian Wars. He said, he called it, quote, and I'm quoting S.L.A. Marshall, it was the most brutal orders ever published to American troops, by Sherman to Sheridan, about just kill everybody. So that's the first thing the government did with this treasury of virtue that they claim to have developed by the war, you know, the war to prevent Southern independence. And then moving along, another example of this is Trump's favorite president, William McKinley. And we had the American conquest of the Philippines, basically, when the Filipinos had finally gotten rid of the Spanish Empire, and the Americans come along and said, hold on there, you're going to become a part of our empire. And they ended up killing, you know, some history books say 200,000 Filipinos. There's some historians say it could have been a million Filipinos who didn't want to be part of anybody else's empire. It's called the Philippine Insurrection. And Teddy Roosevelt, who Bill Clinton once said is his favorite Republican president, was involved in all of this. Jim Powell, my old friend Jim Powell, wrote a biography called Bully Boy of Teddy Roosevelt. And he became president after William McKinley, who was, like I said, Trump's favorite president, was assassinated. Okay, and he justified the mass slaughter of the Filipinos by saying, Jim Powell says, in the same way that the Southerners during the War of the States were dehumanized. That's always what these people always do. They always have to dehumanize the people they're about to try to obliterate. He said, Teddy Roosevelt denounced the Filipinos as, and I'm quoting Teddy Roosevelt now, as Chinese half-breeds, savages, barbarians, a wild and ignorant people, a lesser race. So he actually uses the same phrase that Mises used in Human Action, the lesser races there. And so, and he also said, and then there was a United States Senator, Albert Beveridge of Indiana. He said, the Philippines are ours forever now. The Pacific Ocean is ours. And so, you know, raw imperialism all of a sudden pops up. And another senator, Ben Tillman, joined Beveridge, and he said, the Filipinos are a people racially unfit to govern themselves. Okay. There was another thing that Beveridge said, is that it is our duty, this is a quote of Senator Beveridge, our duty to bring Christianity and civilization to a savage and senile people. Well, at that time, the United States was about 100 years old, a little over 100 years old, but Filipinos had been Catholics for about 400 years at that point. So we're going to bring Christianity to the Philippines, he said. So that's kind of dingbats. They're senators after all. What do you expect? They're in the United States Senate. What do you expect them to say? Okay. But getting back to Teddy Roosevelt again, Jim Powell says that he's always talking about the importance of racial superiority, Teddy Roosevelt. And he said this, all great masterful races have been warlike races. And he denounced what he called the menace of peace. That's Teddy Roosevelt. And shortly after that, he was given the Nobel Peace Prize. You can't make this stuff up. It's like Obama getting the Nobel Peace Prize one day after he was elected president, or whenever that was. It was pretty fast. He couldn't have made anything, done anything for peace. But okay. Well, the Philippine Insurrection followed the brief Spanish-American War, who Teddy called a splendid little war. And he reversed himself, though, after one of his sons was shot down in World War I and died. And he was no longer such a lunatic on war. And on this topic, I quote the famous libertarian scholar from Yale University, William Graham Sumner, wrote this famous essay, "The Conquest of the United States by Spain," about all of this that's going on. Remember, my theme is that it's the treasury of virtue that provides the cover for all of this. It's a plenary indulgence of all sins, past, present, and future, the treasury of virtue, American exceptionalism. And Sumner, a few quotes from Sumner. He said, all of a sudden, there was to be, in old America, he said, there was no grand diplomacy. You know, when you turn on the news on TV and you see Marco Rubio or somebody, they're diplomats. They're going to negotiate with somebody. That didn't exist like it does today. Of course, they had negotiations and treaties, but there wasn't so much of it. But William Graham Sumner claims this sort of started an upward trend in a grand diplomacy, because a lot of Americans still believed in the Jeffersonian dictum of leaving foreigners, don't getting involved in foreign alliances and foreign entanglements, and let people solve their own problems. And so if you believe that, you don't need to send Marco Rubio all around. You know, leave the poor man alone. Let him spend time with his family a little bit. You know, don't send him on a jet every other day to be a diplomat. Okay, but then with the Spanish-American War, William Graham Sumner said, well, we established this, that the new policy direction was to be war, debt, taxation, diplomacy, a grand governmental system, pomp, glory, a big army and navy, lavish expenditures, political jobbery, cronyism, talk to Patrick Newman about that, in a word, imperialism. So he argued that that's why he called this essay "The Conquest of America of the United States by Spain," and that we turned into imperialists just like the Spanish Empire and the British Empire, and I've argued in my writings that was the real purpose of some of the agitators for the Civil War, is that they wanted to create an empire on par with the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, and the other empires in the world, and so that was. Another use, early use of the treasury of virtue. And then there's the conquest and subjugation of Hawaii. The American government in the 1890s, they plotted to overthrow the Hawaiian monarchy. They created something called a Committee of Safety. You know that could be another bumper sticker. Do as we say, or we will organize a Committee of Safety for your country. A committee, politicians in their language. And so this was all businessmen, American businessmen who were behind this. And they sent an envoy named John Stevens, who arranged for American troops to land in Hawaii. And they placed a judge named Sanford Dole as sort of the head of a puppet government in Hawaii. It's easy to create a government if you've got more guns than the people who are currently running the government does, I guess. And they formed a paramilitary organization called the Honolulu Rifles. And they literally forced the Hawaiian king to sign a new constitution, literally at bayonet point. And it came to be known as the Bayonet Constitution. So here's the Americans. This is 1890s. I mean, this 1789 was our constitution is ratified, and with all the everything that goes along with it. And a century later, here they are forcing a new constitution literally at bayonet point on the Hawaiians. I guess they didn't really believe in American constitutionalism in those days. And so he signed it. It disenfranchised all the Asians so that basically the wealthy American landowners had the upper hand in Hawaiian politics. And then a cousin of Sanford Dole, the judge that was put ahead of the new government, his cousin founded the Dole Fruit Company. Well, what a coincidence! So if you go buy some Dole pineapple juice this afternoon, that was the beginning of it. And again, it was the treasury of virtue that's behind all of this. You know, whatever we do is virtuous by virtue of the fact that it's the U.S. government that is doing it. And this is all in the decades immediately after the Civil War. Another good Teddy Roosevelt quote was that about this. He made a speech in Boston. It was very well received, it is said, in Jim Powell's book. And Teddy said, "I feel that it was a crime against the white race that we did not annex Hawaii 3 years ago." They dragged their feet. And they dragged, well, because Grover Cleveland got elected president, he wasn't for this. But he was only in, you know, one term. This, he was his second term there. Okay. And one final thing. I'm taking up all my time after all. One final thing that I'll point out about this whole era, the whole period, the use of the Treasury of Virtue, is the famous essay by Marine Corps General Smedley Butler, that a lot of you know about this. War is a Racket is the name. It's online. Anybody can read it if you've never seen this. And so this is a man who's, he's said to be the most highly decorated Marine Corps officer in U.S. history. This is a World War I era, turn of the century era Marine. And he wrote this book after he's in his retirement, this little book. He said this about his career. He said, "I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and for the bankers. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests. I helped," he's very sarcastic, of course, "I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar corporations." And so he, in his retirement, he decided his whole career that that's what he risked his life for all those years, and was given all those medals and congratulations as being a sort of the hand of imperialism, around the neck of all these people in Nicaragua, Cuba, Mexico, everywhere. And so I guess there are lessons for us today from all this. I'll let you conclude with all, think about what you, all of your lessons are from all of this. But that was the turning point. If you want to know the use of the Treasury of Virtue, it was to carry out the agenda, which I think was always the agenda of the people who wanted a civil war in the first place, is to create an empire, an imperialistic empire, and a mercantilist empire, which was always the dream of Alexander Hamilton, by the way, and the Hamiltonians, a mercantilist empire that would rival the British Empire. And Hamilton himself was always badgering George Washington to go to war with Spain during his day. And so he would have been very welcomed in the McKinley administration, I would think, if he lived that long. And our old friend Gary North, these are all his books, by the way, the late Gary North, he once told me that he once started a little club called the Aaron Burr Club. And Aaron Burr's the man who shot Hamilton to death. And they had ball caps. And in the back of the ball caps, it said, "Not soon enough." in the back of the ball caps. So I think I'll end there, and we'll bring Scott Horton. Now, I'm going to introduce Scott in a second. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for all coming.